Well, I thank Marvin for that very generous introduction. We're glad to be here. I feel it an honor to be with you. Establish our identity as his disciples. But if we fool around and bring division out of diversity, we also will establish our identity, but it won't be that we're disciples of Jesus Christ. So really, we're at a crossroads. And I'm urging you, go back where you are. If you do get one of these books and the material that's in it you feel really hits the issue, send it to someone that you know that is hurting. And I believe, if you'll join me, if just this, us right here today, if you could join in this effort to stem the tide and to pull the stinger out of the issue that is becoming fairly critical, if you can insert love, pull out the stinger, I believe that we will go a long way toward turning a corner, toward a new day for unity in the church. I'm urging you to do that. I'm just anxious to call to your attention some of these principles that are going to be healing, I think, and helpful. Now, today's specific principle that illustrates the general theme, I hope I haven't confused you on that, the general theme of this class is how to differ without dividing. And yesterday we noticed that we've got to realize that diversity is one of the inherent qualities of Christianity. And by bringing unity out of diversity, we establish our identity. Today, the second one of those specific principles is this, that unity consists of both basis and atmosphere. Turn to Ephesians, the fourth chapter. That's what I'm referring to. Ephesians 4, 1 through 6. The Apostle Paul says, I beg you, I beseech you therefore, a prisoner of the Lord, to lead a life worthy of the calling to which you've been called. And here's how we can lead a life worthy of that calling. With all lowliness and meekness, with patience, forbearing one another in love, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. There's one body, one Spirit, just as you were called in the one hope that belongs to your call, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, and one God. Now look, these verses divide themselves easily into two categories. Verses 1 through 3 and verses 4 through 6. I'm going to read the one section of it. Tell me what it is. Is this the basis or the atmosphere of unity? Look at verses 4 through 6. There is one body, one Spirit, one hope, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, and one God. Is that the basis of unity or the atmosphere of unity? Let me hear it. It's the basis. That's the basis of unity. There can't be any biblical Christian unity without that basis. Now, I know you agree with that. Look at the other part of it, though. With all lowliness and meekness, with patience, forbearing one another in love, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. What is that? That's the atmosphere. That's the atmosphere of unity. Lowliness and meekness and long-suffering and eagerness to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. Now, I want to ask you a question. Do you agree that it requires both the basis of unity and the atmosphere of unity in order to bring about the reality of unity? Do you agree with that? Do you understand what I mean now? That it takes the basis and the atmosphere before there can be any real unity. Now, I want to ask you another question. Which of these, if either, have we in the churches of Christ majored in the last, say, 50 or so years? Which one of these two, the basis or the atmosphere, has been our long suit? The basis. Do you wonder why we're divided every way for Sunday? It has been that we have emphasized the basis almost to the near exclusion of the atmosphere. In fact, so many times we've advocated the basis with such a poor attitude that it almost makes a person not even want to be united with us. No, we've got to emphasize both the basis and the atmosphere and have them both together in the proper portion if there's to be genuine unity. Okay, that's the second principle we'll leave with you and then progress on into the particulars that relate to the Crossroads Ministries as they are coming into our congregations of the established church. Having seen yesterday some circumstances, some criticisms and some contributing factors that bring about all this problem, today we want to consider two of the four major areas in which we find friction existing wherever campus ministries are brought into contact with existing congregations, and particularly campus ministries that are from Gainesville in Florida. Now, these four major areas are these. You may have some other ones, but I've chosen these four because I think they're pretty well, they're umbrella. They are umbrella issues. They are shepherding, evangelizing, the development of a mature morality, and the use of disfellowship or fellowship as a tool for discipline. We're going to notice both the current shortcomings of the established church, and we've got some, and anybody that thinks that we don't have any shortcomings, I believe you'll get in anyway. I think the Lord will just let you in because He knows that you don't really have enough perception to really do any thinking much anyway. We've got problems. But look, that's not anything new. I know that we're a New Testament church if we've got problems, because about 3/4 of the New Testament never would have been written had it not been written to address churches with problems. So having problems, that's no problem for me. We've got problems. Okay, the current existing shortcomings. But then there are also current abuses that the campus ministries are falling into that they're unaware of. And whether they'll hear it or not, I don't know. Whether you'll hear what I'm saying as established churches, I don't know. But let's have a go at it and see. Two that we're going to notice today are these: shepherding and evangelizing. Number one, the shepherding. I want to notice and just write down the shortcomings in the established church. Capsuled, it would be this. Most congregations have been raised under a system of little or no individual counseling being done by the shepherds. Little or no individual shepherding being done. Now, you say, what do you mean by that? I mean simply this, that we've been raised generally in a system where the elders have functioned more as a board of directors meeting in a conference room behind closed doors to make, and I have not noticed this, but until recently, someone pointed out that most of the prayers for our elders are prayers that they might make the right decisions. I wish they hadn't told me that, because every time I hear a prayer and I know, and we're going to start praying for the elders, I say, oh, no, don't pray, please, for the elders. Because I know that sure enough, and here it comes, help the elders to make the right decisions. When are we going to start praying, help the elders to be able to walk with the sheep and to give them the right advice? That's what we lack today. We are in a system that has emphasized elders as members of a board of directors, and the shepherding that is done in congregations is done primarily by proxy. It's done through teachers in classrooms, and it's done through preachers in the pulpits and in their studies or their counseling areas. Now, that's the way that we've been raised. We're just that by nature. And the elders themselves, listen, you know who one of the most obvious villains in this whole misrepresentation or this whole problem is? It's us preachers. Yeah. You know what preachers do whenever people have problems in the church? Where do the preachers come in? Well, they're there in the office. People call up crying and bawling and squalling, you know, because their marriage is going down the drain. How many preachers do you know that say, hold on just a moment, and I'll give you Brother Jones's number. He's one of our elders, and he's expert in this area. You call him. Well, we don't do that. Preachers jump right in there. They isolate the elders from the problems. And so how in the world can you expect elders to be dealing with problems if preachers keep getting in the way and serving as insulators so the elders don't know anything about it? You know who are the last people in the church to know about problems in the church? Elders. Preachers know about it. But elders don't know about it, and it's not always their fault. We have perpetuated a system that almost safeguards itself from correction. And the elders are sitting in the middle of it, the preachers are surrounding them, and the poor sheep are out there on the edge is just going to hell and not knowing what to do about it. And we've got to make some changes. Now, not only is that true, but here are some reasons why it's true, that our elders are functioning in a way of board of directors. Here's some of the contributing factors. Number one, the number of elders that we have in most congregations is insufficient to provide adequate opportunity for extensive personalized shepherding. We just don't have the men to do it. Whenever five men shepherd 2,000 people or 1,000 people, you can't do it. There's no way those men can do it. And part of those closed doors is to protect them because they feel intimidated at the absolute enormity of the task that they haven't one hope of solving. They cannot hope to address it, and consequently, they have stepped back, closed the door, and have satisfied themselves with making decisions in meetings like that. But a lot of it, I think, is just simply to protect them from the absolute impossibility of the task that confronts them. The number of elders is not sufficient to take care of personalized individual shepherding, to say nothing of being adequate to do initiative counseling. And I mean by that initiative, let me put it in another term. What we're urging to be done today is preventive counseling, preventive shepherding, where the elders approach the members and say, "How is your life coming?" Go to their home and say, "We'd love to just come and sit and visit with you." It would scare the living daylights out of most members of the church if the elders would call up and say, "John, I'd like to come visit with you tonight." We would say, "Oh, mercy, what have I done?" But we don't have the number of men as elders to be able to do that kind of initiative, preventive shepherding. We just don't have them. Now, here's the kicker, though. If the elders of our generation were to be able to and were to offer to do intimate, personal shepherding of members of the church, would accept it if they offered it. Tried. If the elders of most congregations would come up to them, to some member of the church they heard is going to build a $140,000 home, and they knew that this couple was going to have to, she was going to have to go to work, the children were going to have to be put in a babysitter's home, he was going to have to take two jobs, and if they prayerfully considered that and went to them and said, "You know, John, you and Judy, we heard of your plans to build this house, and we're just thankful that you want something that's nice," but they said, "It's our prayerful consideration that it's beyond your ability to pay for. And if it means that you're going to have to go to work, Judy, and John, you're going to have to take two jobs, and the babies are going to have to go to a babysitter, we believe that it will jeopardize your marriage. We believe that it will jeopardize your health. We think it will jeopardize your soul. We're urging you prayerfully, please don't build it." I think most members of the church today, and I may be overreacting, but I think most members of the church would become very incensed, very defensive, and would say, in effect, "What right do you have to tell us to build or not build a house?" Now, you may not even agree with that. You think that would, is that overdrawing it? I don't know whether they would tell the elders that or not, but I suspect they would say to each other, "That's none of their business." But let me tell you something, it is their business. We're not ready to accept it any more than they're able and to give it. Okay, let me just say this in passing. Brother Lemons has said often in his editorials, he's been pleading and begging with us to look and to do some revising and to be able to break the shackles of traditions that have absolutely brought us to a standstill. I urge you to listen. Listen to what he's saying. Listen to the other men who are speaking out about it. There's a groundswell of dissatisfaction in the churches of Christ today because of the fact that we're being stifled by a leadership that is not responsive to the needs of the membership. In fact, not only are they not responsive, they don't know what the needs are. One lady this very day, I had lunch with her. She drove all the way about 250 miles from her home to come and talk with me for 1 hour. And the message that she gave me was this: our elders don't know what we need. We never see them. And you say, well, that's the fault of the elders, perhaps. But I suspect it's our fault that we don't do something about it to rectify the problem and provide the body with enough shepherds so they can know the needs of the sheep. But let me just say in passing, the churches of Christ today can no longer stand the kind of shepherding that we've been receiving over the last 100 years. There has got to be a change. And God will bless us. He'll bring it about. Let me urge you, stick in there together. Don't split. Don't separate yourself from the body. Pray for our elders. Pray for our own love and our own responsiveness to them. And then pray that God will bring this unity together and will satisfy the needs of the body. Now, let's notice the current abuses by the campus ministries that we see. The current abuses by the campus ministries, the abuse is caused partly by the kind of people being converted and shepherded. These people that are being converted and shepherded off of the college campuses, they have little or no external and internal discipline in their past lives. They're being brought out of the raw world. They're being brought out of a generation that has been pampered and petted and permitted to do about anything and everything without anybody restricting them. They have no internal restraints to speak of. They have been stripped of any external restraints. And so these people are being converted from that kind of background. Consequently, they're open to the influence of an authority figure. They're open to the influence of authoritative figures because, you see, these young people who have been deprived of any discipline in the past by their parents and all, they look at restrictions or they look at discipline and they look at close supervision as a concrete expression of love. That's right. Your own children. When you think you're afraid to put any boundaries on them, don't be afraid to put restrictions on your children. Children look at boundaries and restrictions, if they're reasonable, they look at those restrictions as being expressions of love. These children were brought up without that kind of expression. And when they come into a movement that is willing by some kind of expression, either verbal or body language, to express pleasure or displeasure, that sets boundaries and gives them some idea about what's right or wrong, they come in and are willing to be told that, and they leave themselves open to that kind of influence, but it ends up in being a programming if we're not careful. Now, because of this fact, so many times those in the campus ministry say, but we don't tell them that they can't do that. Well, maybe not verbally, but you know what? Body language is so much more powerful than verbal language. You can tell a person with body language, I do not approve of what you're doing. And you do it in a number of ways. You know, you can do it with your arms crossed, and you can frown, or you can do it from just withdrawing yourself from their presence until they shape up. Listen, there are any number of ways to express displeasure with you for the way you've been acting. If you don't believe it, just watch your wife the next time she's put out with the way you've been acting. She knows full well how to tell you, if not verbally, non-verbally, don't ever touch me again. She knows how. Yes, sir. Well, okay, so what we find ourselves, one of the pitfalls is this. There's the possibility, given the people that are being brought into the campus ministries or the movement, there's a possibility and a very likelihood of mass manipulation, mass conformity, a regimentation which results in a loss of freedom. Now, I know that's a serious charge, but I'm convinced that it's true, that because of the nature of the converts, we find ourselves faced with a possibility that the ones being brought in will be counseled in such a way, shepherded in such a way, that they will be almost pressed into a mold of conformity to where they lose their personal freedom. Now, here's what compounds that. Not only is it the nature of the people that are being converted that makes it a possibility, but do you know what compounds that possibility into a probability? The ones who are doing the converting of these people are also doing the counseling of these people. The ones who are doing the evangelizing are doing the shepherding. Yeah. Well, you say, that ought to stop. Well, okay. Have you got an alternative? I guarantee you, if you convert someone, you're going to be terribly jealous that they get the right feeding. When we were overseas in New Zealand, I went over there as an evangelist. I didn't go as an elder. Never had thought about being an elder. Went over there as an evangelist. We've converted all these people, all these young squalling young'uns, you know, these baby Christians running around. They didn't know how to live. All of a sudden, surprise, surprise, guess what I became? I became an elder. I didn't do it willingly, but I didn't have anybody to take them to. If I'd had somebody to take them to and I'd say, here, take care of him, I'm going to get some more, I think I would have. But who was I to take them to? I went over there as an evangelist, but the sheer fact of the matter was that I, as an evangelist, when new Christians were born, I became their shepherd. Now, that's what's happening in the campus ministries, either intentionally or unintentionally. Here's what happens. When these new converts are brought in, instead of them being brought to the elders and told, take care of this one and feed him right, I'm going after some more, there has been an overt effort to keep these people who are converted aside so that they can be taught in a way that the campus ministers think is appropriate. Now look, that is a conscious effort. I'm not saying that it is an ulterior motive. I'm just saying that they're consciously concerned about the ones that they convert. You cannot flaw that. What alternative do we have? There's not a congregation among us where the campus ministries have come in and are existing side by side with the local congregation. There's not a congregation among us today that is staffed by sufficient eldership to take care of the emotional and spiritual needs of the number of people being brought in by the campus ministries. There's not a one among us that can do that. If they were to do what? If they were to bring all the ones they're converting and lay them at the feet of these elders and say, or put them in their lap, you know, here they come, and they put it in the lap of this elder and say, okay, take care of him, we're going to get some more. And in 4 or 5 days, here they come with another one and drop that one in the lap of these elders, and they say, take care of those, we're coming back in a minute. And here they come. It wouldn't take long for the elder to say, wait, don't. I've got more of them now that I can handle. That's what we'd have to say. Now, a practical suggestion. If you don't want a movement within a movement developing, and that's what happens whenever those who evangelize also do the shepherding, if they're forced to do it by practicalities because the number of elders does not allow them the possibility of somebody else doing the shepherding, then we're forcing a movement to develop within a movement, and that's always going to force a division. Supplementary counseling and supplementary shepherding to be done in addition to what the 5 or 6 men can do who are shepherding our congregations. If they don't go out and provide a broadened base of counseling, we're going to be failing in meeting the needs of the members of the body today. We're not going to meet them like we've been approaching it. So that can be done, but something else is necessary. If the established church is able and willing to provide a broadened base for shepherding, you know what's going to have to happen on the part of the campus ministries? The campus ministers are going to have to be willing to relinquish the lives, relinquish those converts, and say to them, now look, these men aren't perfect that we're going to be turning you over to. We're going to keep in touch with you. These men as elders, they're not perfect. The people they've got helping them aren't perfect, but we're turning them over to you for counseling, for development, for maturing. It may take them longer, but we don't have any option. In order to make this a unified effort, we're willing to relinquish you to them. Now let me tell you something. That's going to be a big, big issue, because the campus ministers that I'm familiar with are not willing to turn their converts over to the present elderships. They're not willing. And listen, brethren, that's a serious problem. We've got to address it. Do you understand? Am I on track? Do you understand what I'm saying? If we'll provide a broadened base, and if the campus ministers will turn those new converts over to that broadened base, then the new converts will begin resembling whom instead of whom. They'll begin resembling the whole body instead of just the one that converted them and just the one who saves them for his own counseling. As sure as you let that happen, the one that converts them, counsels them, you know who that new convert's going to look just exactly like? He's going to look just exactly like his pappy or his mammy. Sure he will. But if you haven't conceived him, take him and put him in the elder's arms and the other members of the church's arms, he's going to start taking upon himself the nature of the whole body. They say, well, we don't want him to look like the whole body. That's too bad. We are a part of the same body. And unless you're driving headlong into a state of division, we will provide the expanded base, and the campus ministries will relinquish those lives so that they can be counseled by the whole body. Okay, let's leave that and go to the second conflict, the area of conflict, and that's evangelizing. Number one, here's the shortcoming of the present system. We have done evangelism by proxy. Just about it. When we can figure out a way to bring somebody to a building to hear somebody else witness to them about Jesus Christ, we feel like that's about the ultimate in evangelizing. Now, there's a whole generation of people stretching back 50 years, and our concept of evangelism has been one focal point. The preacher is the one focal point. The pulpit is the one focal point. And we have accepted evangelism as being something done by somebody else, somewhere else, and certainly not me. And we, most of us, have become witnesses in a sense that we sit there and watch somebody else do it. That is the basic concept that is stifling the growth in the church today. That's got to change. That has come about from a misunderstanding of the nature of the Christian assembly. I believe there's a basic misunderstanding about the nature of the Christian assembly. The Christian assembly is not for the world. Never has been. Never will be. And yet we're guilty of taking the Christian assembly, and I'm going to strip it right down to the bare minimum, the time when the body of the Lord gathers around the table. We have been guilty of taking that Christian assembly, and I'm not standing here if we haven't devoted the majority of the preaching that comes from the pulpit, even at that hour, we have devoted it and directed it to the sinners on the outside of the world, on the outside, and really they are on the outside because they're not on the inside. They're not even there. But first principle sermons that starve the Christians and miss the sinners are being used and presented at even around the table. And even when we present one to the Christians, we feel terribly guilty if we don't revise it and shift gears at the end and extend an invitation to those who are not Christians. There are Christians all over this world in the church who are literally dying from starvation. They are famishing from a lack of feeding. That's the first thing that's happened. And a second thing has happened. We have created an unconscious mentality that evangelism is to be done in the building by the preacher and not by us on the outside. And it's an unconscious thing, and it's like pulling our teeth to get us away from it. But we're going to have to get back to the biblical concept of the assembly. Read 1 Corinthians, the 14th chapter, verses 3, 4, 5, 12, 17, 26, and 31. I know that's too fast. Let me read them again. 1 Corinthians 14, verses 3, 4, 5, 12, 17, 26, and 31. And who would like to suggest or offer what is that phrase that's used there? Let everything that is done be done to what? To edify. Let it be done to build up the what? To build up the church. That is the most detailed instruction on the nature of the Christian assembly that we have. But somebody says, well then nobody, who's going to do the evangelizing? Oh, brethren, if we'll start feeding the body of the Lord Jesus Christ like we ought to, whenever the body is turned loose, the body itself will do the evangelizing. That's the only way we're ever going to be able to make any kind of an impression on the world today. All right. Let me just simply say this. The established church must take its hats off to the campus ministries in the area of evangelism. There ain't no way that you can criticize what they're doing as far as their desire, their intensity, maybe their methods. You think, well, they're too extreme. That may be true. But I'll tell you what, I like the way they're doing it a whole lot better than I like the way we're not doing it.
That's right.
Now, there are some abuses. Let me mention them just four as we close now. Number one, these campus ministries, the friction is not over their methods of evangelism, but over their attitude regarding other people and their method of evangelism. For example, campus ministries must broaden their definition of evangelism to include about four extra groups of people that they hadn't thought about including. Number one, older people who have not been trained to verbalize their faith. They've been trained to bake cookies or cakes and wash feet and take care of people when they're sick and paint their houses and do anything, raise barns, do anything under heaven, but don't ask them to verbalize. Let me save us some time. Rather than try to train those 65 and 70-year-old Christians who have spent a generation or two never being trained to verbalize, let's just put a plow to them and let them go ahead and plow. Let them plow. We'll come along and plant after them. Let them say, oh my, they fall apart. They get nervous. Can't we use them as plowers? We can. Read John the 4th chapter, verses 37 and 38, as Jesus talks about the diversification in the harvest process. He said, some are planters, some are harvesters, so that all can rejoice together, so that the planters and the harvesters can all rejoice together. Everybody doesn't have to be a harvester. Everybody doesn't have to be a waterer. Everybody doesn't have to be a planter. Everybody doesn't have to be a plower. But all working together, we can do it. So redefine to include those older people. Secondly, redefine the definition of evangelism to include those people whose major talent may be contributing to the financial support of the campus ministers. Who do you think supports you? I've asked these good brethren of mine, who do you think supports you so you can run and gun on campus? I'll guarantee you one thing, it's not the ones you've converted, they're not supporting you. Oh, they will, but you'd sure be eating a lot of beans if only the young people were supporting you. It's these older people whose major talent may be the supporting of people financially. Now, is that scriptural? You bet it is. In Romans, the 12th chapter, verses 3 through 8, it talks about seven talents, and none of these perhaps is exclusive, and perhaps all of them overlap. But Paul says, don't think of yourself more highly than you ought to think. You can't do it all. That's all I need. One of those talents that he mentions is that he whose gift is contributing, let him do it with generosity or liberality. And he also talked about the person whose gift was teaching and mercy and all these other gifts, seven of them, Romans the 12th chapter, verses 3 through 8. Thirdly, the campus ministers must expand their definition of evangelism to include those people whose method may differ from theirs. Door knocking may not be your method. I confess, door knocking is not mine. My sister's worse than I am. She'd rather be told we're going skydiving. Your method may not be soul talks. Your method may be walking around a golf course and finding someone to play golf with. I converted a man like that recently. Met him on a golf course, asked him to play with me, took him home to dinner, began to love him and take care of him. From then on, he was converted about 6 months later. Yeah, that's just a certain method. What's your method? Then get out there and use it. But the definition of evangelism has to be broadened to include those different methods. Then fourthly, their definition of evangelism must be broadened to include those people whose circumstances differ from theirs. These people, many times, as they began most of the time, are they married or single? They're single. How many hours can a single person spend on evangelizing? As many as his heart desires. What happens when he gets married? Well, he's got somebody else to think about then. Now, is that scriptural also? Read 1 Corinthians 7. He just simply concedes that a person who is married doesn't have as much time to do things as the person who's single. Now, he just concedes that. But he says you don't sin if you marry. Okay, what about people when they have children? Is there to be any adjustment made in a person's schedule when his children come along? Well, you better make some adjustment in your schedule of evangelizing when your children come along, because if you don't, you stand a real good chance of having your children grow up to hate both you and the church. And we've already seen in the past years what happens when preachers are so busy preaching and doing what they call the work of the kingdom that they don't have time to spend with their little boys and girls. You've seen how many children have grown up in that atmosphere and have been alienated from the church forever. We've got to adjust our schedules to accommodate and to make allowance for the different circumstances in life through which you pass. It doesn't mean that you quit evangelizing, but when you're married and when you have children, your home becomes your evangelistic outpost. Man, you start having people for dinner. You start inviting them over. But you don't have to go to a soul talk to do it, or you don't have to go to some kind of another Bible study. Have your own in your own home. Okay, now look, you're seeing these things. Now watch what happens as we close. Unless this is done, unless this definition of evangelism is broadened, alienation and estrangement is going to be brought into any congregation where a bunch of young upstarts come in and say, there's only one way to do it. And we're doing it, and unless you do it like we do it, you're not at it, you're not spiritual, you're not evangelizing. Now, if it can be that our campus ministries can come in with the wisdom to say, look, we're here to help, and we've got a way of doing it, and we're going to do it our way, you do it your way, and instead of doing like this, they'll be doing like this, and it's going to include all the people in the church, and everybody's going to feel like they have a part in the great work of evangelizing the world, and there's going to be so much fun. There can't be division. Okay, tomorrow we're going to study these last two, and they're important. The major one is, how do you develop into a mature morality? And then how do you use discipline as a mean, or disfellowship as a means of discipline? My goodness, you're a good group. We'll see you later. The books are available here or in those places that have been announced.